You're listening to part two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show podcast.
:30 in the morning, Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. We're working to get Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on to join us to talk about the Blues ahead of tomorrow afternoon's Jets-Blues game here in Winnipeg. Complete coverage, of course, beginning with H&L game day at 11 a.m. tomorrow. Rick Ralph, of course, will do his thing at 1 o'clock and puck drop at 2 p.m. tomorrow afternoon for the Jets and Blues at MTS Center. Still to come later on today, of course, here on TSN 1290. Game two of the Jays-Royals as the Jays look to bounce back from yesterday's 5-0 defeat at the hands of the Kansas City Royals.
They just got
to
get that offense going again. I mean, I didn't expect them to win game one because I thought they drank too much champagne after they won the ALDS, so the Jays will be fine.
The Jays will be fine. Good. As he reassures everybody that's a Jays fan.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He covers the St. Louis Blues. Jeremy Rutherford joins us from Vancouver, where the Blues played last night. Jeremy, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How about yourself, buddy?
Great.
That's good. Nice road trip for the Blues so far. Successful one as they've done the Western Canadian stops, defeating the Vancouver Canucks last night. But a little bit, with all good news comes a little bit of a gray cloud. Paul Stastny leaving the game yesterday. We know that Kevin Shattenkirk's still out of the lineup. Any update on those two players heading into tomorrow afternoon in Winnipeg?
No, not just yet. Paul Stastny taking a shot off the right foot leg last night, and he left the game. He tried to come back for the start of the third period, took a twirl around the rink, and couldn't do it, so he went back to the locker room. No update. Ken Hitchcock said that would come today. And then Kevin Shattenkirk, I don't know that I'd expect him to play on Sunday against the Jets. He hasn't practiced in the past couple days. He suffered a lower body injury on this road trip, and I think the word that they're using is they want to take some precaution with it. It's nothing serious. It's day-to-day, but without him practicing the past couple of days, I couldn't see him in the lineup on Sunday.
You know, Jeremy, we're in Winnipeg, so we got to ask you about Alex Steen. He's got 4 points in his last two games, and he's really been clicking with Vladimir Tarasenko. Does Alex Steen seem like a player to you that has more to prove this year, maybe being a veteran guy and wanting to get this Blues team further in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think he's one of the guys who takes it pretty personal when they don't go that far. He's one of the leaders, obviously an assistant captain. And, we talked to him in training camp, and he said that, he was pleased with his season last year. It was a career high in points, but he felt like he was kind of up and down. So he said he wanted to be more consistent with his game. And, Ken Hitchcock likes to mix up his lines and change things up fairly often. And, the players like it when it's a little more normal. So I think going into the season to hear that he was going to be on a line with Stastny and Tarasenko, I think he was thrilled with that. So they showed a lot of chemistry in training camp, and they've looked terrific so far in the regular season, especially these past two games. A couple nice passing sequences for that line have led to some big goals for the Blues the past couple nights.
Jeremy, look at the big move over the offseason, Troy Brouwer in and TJ Oshie out. How has that move worked so far, and how has Brouwer acquitted himself with the lineup?
I think, that was one of those deals where the Blues had to do something. When you had three first-round playoff exits, I think the fans were waiting for something to happen, and quite honestly, I think fans thought that more turnover would happen. But it's hard, the old cliche, it's hard to make trades this day and age in the NHL with the salary cap. You're talking about dollar-for-dollar deals. But Doug Armstrong found a deal, Troy Brouwer, for TJ Oshie. And I think, to be honest with you guys, that at first Blues fans were a little bit underwhelmed when they heard that, okay, TJ Oshie is the one who's going and it's Troy Brouwer coming. Maybe they didn't know enough about Troy Brouwer's game. TJ Oshie has a lot of skill, and he's a guy who's scored 60 points in the league a couple times. But Troy Brouwer, even though he hasn't put up those kind of points, he's got a lot to his game. He's already shown just in five games that he's a guy who can He scored a breakaway goal. He's a guy who parks in front of the net. He's a guy who gets in the corners and grinds. I think he's fit in very well with this team, and I think given the Blues something that they didn't have.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He covers the Blues. Jeremy, you know, you look at the goaltending for the Blues, and it's sort of been the same situation for the last number of years. You got Brian Elliott and Jake Allen, and they generally split the regular season. Last year, Elliott with 45 starts, Jake Allen with 32 starts. You know, is Ken Hitchcock hoping that one of these two players sort of takes the ball and runs for it? And you know, we keep hearing Jake Allen, goaltender of the future, goaltender of the future, goaltender of the future. When is the future really upon us for Jake Allen?
Well, I thought it would have been game one of this season that they were going to give him the ball and tell him to run with it for this reason, because they named him the playoff goalie. I thought that was kind of the thing that turned things last year. When you go with Brian Elliott as your 1A last year and then turn to Jake Allen at playoff time, I think that's when you've kind of said, okay, well, now we're making up our mind. But that's not what happened in training camp. The Blues said, we're not naming a starter. The job is up for grabs. We're going to give both guys an opportunity in the month of October, and we'll see who grabs it and runs with it. I think that was done in part because the Blues knew that they had this big, long road trip. You're talking six games, the Western Canadiens swing, and then on to Winnipeg Sunday, and then Montreal on Tuesday. This is a big trip, and you can't just lean on one guy. So I think they knew that they were going to need both guys early on, and why not keep it open and say, hey, who plays well? So Brian Elliott has played really well so far in his three games. He's won them all. And Jake Allen, last night, his second appearance of the season here in Vancouver, he gets the win. So right now it's both of the guys, but you got to give a tip of the cap to Brian Elliott. The Blues have overlooked him three times in his career here in St. Louis come playoff time. And he continues to show up and do his job the next year. So kudos to him.
Jeremy, Jets fans that are going to watch this St. Louis Blues team on Sunday afternoon are going to see a couple of new defensemen there, Joel Edmondson and then Colton Perico, who scored a couple of goals against the Calgary Flames earlier in the week, including the game winner. What have been your impressions of those two young defensemen so far?
Well, it's been pretty remarkable just making the team. And then not only making the team, but being in the starting lineup and for Perico being on the number two power play unit. I didn't give these guys necessarily a chance to make the team. When you talk about the Blues this offseason, telling everybody that Robert Bortuzzo and Petteri Lindbom would be their third pair, and that they signed Chris Butler to be their seventh guy, you thought it was set in stone. So then come opening night, Robert Bortuzzo's a healthy scratch, Petteri Lindbom's in the minors, and Chris Butler's in the minors. It was just completely different than what everyone expected. And I think it's because of the play of these two rookies. You got a pair of 22-year-old guys in Parayko and Edmondson, and they've just been terrific. They were two of the better defensemen in camp, and so the Blues have given them the opportunity. Parayko, real quick, he's got an amazing story. 6'5", 225 pounds. He's chiseled. I think he's got next to no body fat percentage.
Just like Drew, Jeremy.
Yeah, just like Drew. He's and myself here, too.
Yeah. Must be talking about a different Drew, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he played AA. He didn't even play AAA. He was passed over in the Western Hockey League draft. And then he went to college and played at Alaska Fairbanks. So nobody knew about the kid. The Blues take him in the third round, 2012. And, you know, he admits that he was Bambi at the time. But now he looks terrific, and so I think the Blues feel like they've found a gem in Parayko, and that's to take nothing away from Edmondson, who's been good as well.
And Jeremy, you look at Dmitry Yaskin, and a guy who's got the talent, certainly has the talent, and you wrote about it early on prior to training camp about the Blues wanting him to take on a bigger role this year, and so far he hasn't produced anything really. I guess a broader question, is he fast enough to keep up with the NHL pace?
You know, he's big, and I think he's not slow. But they have looked for him to take a bigger role it hasn't quite happened here. But, you know, he's a guy who scored 99 points in the Quebec League. Mm-hmm. So they know that he's got some skill. But right now and in the past couple of years, the best they could do for him is a third-line role. And so, like, right now they have him with David Backes, and there just hasn't been a lot of chemistry in the early going with those two. So, you know, is he fast enough? I guess it remains to be seen. But, I know he's got some skill, and you see him at times show what he can do. It just hasn't been on a consistent basis. So I think the book's still out on him.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is Jeremy Rutherford talking about the St. Louis Blues ahead of tomorrow afternoon's Blues-Jets game in Winnipeg. Jeremy, another guy that's out of the Blues lineup is Robbie Fabry, former first-round pick of the Blues last year. You know, he had played a couple games, and then he's out with a concussion. You know, what were the hopes for the Blues, you know, for Fabry entering the season? Were they surprised that he made the team out of training camp? What element? I mean, he's a skilled player. He's not big at all, so he's got the skill size. How important was that element to the Blues going forward?
Yeah, it's weird. We're talking about all these kids, two 22-year-old defensemen and now a 19-year-old forward. You know, it's not typical of a Ken Hitchcock team to have all these young guys. But, you know, Robbie Fabry is a guy, like you said, first-round draft pick last year. He had a great camp last year. And could have made the team, if not for an injury late in the camp. He went back to junior, and then, of course, he had the ankle injury at the World Junior Championships. So he comes back this year, and he has another great camp, and he makes the team. I don't think it was any surprise that the Blues at least were going to keep him for the 9 games, and I think, honestly, the Blues felt like he could stay for the whole season. But in Game 2 in Minnesota, he takes a hit from Chris Porter. Doug Armstrong, knowing Chris Porter, who played for the Blues for a long time, said that he thought it was an innocent hit by an honest player. But nonetheless, you know how it goes these days. Any hit can cause some damage. And so Robbie Fabry gets the concussion. And so it's just going to stall the situation here. I think when he does come back, when he is healthy, whether it's tomorrow or next week or next month, they're going to let him finish out and play some games and see what he can do. And if he shows well, like he did before the injury, then I think he'll stay, but I think this has kind of put a damper on things for the time being. But a kid who's got a lot of skill and the word that Ken Hitchcock likes to use, a lot of anticipation for the play. He really knows what's coming up next, and I think that's why they like his future.
Jeremy, a couple of Scotties, if you want to say that, are getting a chance with the Blues due to injury, Upshaw and Gomez. Out of those two players, which do you see having a bigger role on the Blues this year?
Well, I think right now it's Scotty Upshaw. He's the one who's been in the lineup the past couple games, and he's been in a top 9 role. You know, he's only 30 years old. Everybody thinks that Scotty Upshaw's been around so long and his career's done, but just 30 years old. So I know that he struggled the past couple years in Florida, but the Blues got both of those guys on tryouts, and that was kind of a byproduct of the free agency situation. The market was flooded, and teams were at their cap number. So they get these guys really cheap on 1-year two-way deals, both of them under $1 million, both of them. And Upshaw has played pretty well, I think, in the couple games that the Blues have put him in the lineup. He had a goal in Calgary the other night. And then Scott Gomez, everybody knows his story, and now 35 years old, but we talked to him last night before the game, and you know, I didn't know Scott Gomez very well, but to sit there and listen to him last night before the game and say, look, I'm here to pass along what the older veterans have done for me. And he was talking about the Marty Brodeurs and the Bobby Hajeliks and so on and so forth. And he said, I got to be that type of player. I got to be the guy who I play when I play, and when I'm not playing, I'm passing along that knowledge. And so I was really impressed, to hear what Scotty Gomez had to say. And so he slips into the lineup last night, and he's not a fourth line player, and we all know he's a center, but last night he plays fourth line right wing. And I thought he gave the fourth line an identity. They actually looked like they were playing some hockey. So I don't know whether he'll be in the lineup come Sunday. Ryan Reeves, the local boy in Winnipeg, he might get back in the lineup. He was the guy who sat last night. I would expect him to get back in the lineup against the Jets, but we'll see. But at the bottom line is that Scotty Upshaw and Scott Gomez have given the Blues some good veteran depth.
Is that the Marty Brodeur influence, getting Scotty Gomez in on the PTO, you figure?
Yeah, I think that had something to do with it. I asked Scott Gomez that, and he said, if Marty Brodeur told me to jump off a bridge, I don't know that I'd do that. But yeah, sure, anytime a good friend like Marty's calling you and saying, hey, this is a good situation here. I think that had to have some influence.
Jeremy, final question, and Ken Hitchcock kind of going into that final year of his deal. How is, has he changed at all in terms of I have nothing to lose, anything like that, or is it the same Ken Hitchcock it always is?
It's hard to read, you know, this early in the season, especially when you're talking to a guy who's 63, 64. I don't think there's going to be much change, but he has to. He really does adapt. You know, I think that he's done that over his career. That's what's led to the longevity. And you have to change after three first-round playoff exits. I mean, you can't keep hitting your head like that. So I think that the Blues did reach out to Mike Babcock. I know they did. I think they talked to Todd McClellan. And none of those guys, in part because of the relationship with Ken Hitchcock, wanted a piece of this job. So Doug Armstrong said that Ken Hitchcock is going to be our guy. And so I think he's come back and said, hey, look, this is a good team. We need to make some tweaks. They've done some things with their system. They've given some different guys some opportunities. But I think at the end of the day, he's still Ken Hitchcock, and he's going to do what he's going to do. So it's been a team that's been really, really close the past couple years, even though they haven't advanced. You're talking about one of the better teams in the regular season. And I think they're just going to try to give this thing one more try with everybody in place.
Jeremy Rutherford covers the St. Louis Blues for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He joins us from Vancouver, where the Blues will travel to Winnipeg later on this afternoon. Jeremy, thanks very much for doing this. We'll see you tomorrow at the game, buddy.
Hey, we'll see you at the rink. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jeremy. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, the Edmonton Oilers, the new Edmonton Oilers, same as the old Oilers. You're listening to TSN 1290. Death, taxes, the Edmonton Oilers not being very good. Three things you can count on. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment of the show brought to you by our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. All this week at Rumors, Eliza Schlesinger completely sold out. Seven sold-out shows, as there always are at Rumors Comedy Club. Get your tickets now, rumorscomedyclub.com.
Yeah, Drew, a lot of people were tweeting yesterday about going to see Eliza Schlesinger, and on my Instagram account, a lot of people are taking pictures with her. Mm-hmm. A very funny woman.
Yes.
So if you have a chance, I'm not going to be able to have a chance. I'm out of town, and I've obviously got a very busy schedule here with all this hockey, but if you have a chance and you have tickets, then you're going to be in for a good show.
Yes, if you have tickets, because if you don't have tickets, you do not have a chance at this point. All tickets sold out to see Eliza Schlesinger at Rumors this weekend. The Edmonton Oilers have started in the Edmonton Oilers' perfect fashion with an 0-4-0 record, losing their home opener on Thursday night to the St. Louis Blues. Here's Taylor Hall. I think the whole fan base is impatient right now, and we are feeling that right now. Hall said, we don't want to be down 0-4 to start the year. That's probably the worst-case scenario. When you looked at it midsummer, that is probably the worst you could have imagined. We have to find a way. Here's Todd McClellan, veteran head coach, on Connor McDavid. I don't know how much pressure he's feeling. I think I do. But I don't know how much he carries, how much of the pressure he carries. I think he feels there's a large chunk of our 0-4 record probably falls onto his shoulders. I did pull him aside in Dallas and talk to him about the shared pieces of pressure in terms of wins and losses. When it goes good, he's only going to have a little bit of it. When it goes bad, he's only going to have a little bit of it. Are the Edmonton Oilers already ruining Connor McDavid 4 games into his NHL career?
No, they're not ruining Connor McDavid. I mean, this Oilers team, I didn't think was going to come out of the gates, Richie, and completely shock everybody and start the season off 10-0. I mean, it's 4 games, first of all, and they've lost to some good teams. They lost to St. Louis last night. But, you know, you look at this team and how they're constructed. They got better in goal. Cam Talbot is an upgrade over Ben Scrivens in goal. They got better on defense, Rich. They go out and they get a guy like Sakara and We know some of the other moves they made, bringing in Griffin Reinhardt. Griba is another guy they brought in. But this team is still very young, and you've got a lot of first overall picks with Taylor Hall and Yakupov, and you know Drew just mentioned Connor McDavid, and Eberle's injured right now, so they definitely miss Jordan Eberle. But you want to get some wins here. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You don't want to keep getting further and further out of the playoff race early on here. And you've got a big game against Calgary tonight. But this Oilers team, still rich. I think it struggles at times from a kind of lack of an identity and a lack of leadership. And you saw them take away the C from Andrew Ferentz, which I think was a good decision because I think we know who the leadership core of this team is. I mean, it's the young, it's the Taylor Halls, it's the Jordan Eberles, right? It's going to be Connor McDavid going forward, right, Rich? Mm-hmm. But to me, you watch this team and they're getting better and they've improved and you're starting to see them not give up too many weak goals like you saw because Talbot is a very good young goalie. But five goals in the first four games, they're still struggling to find offense from different players, right? You're still seeing them get outskated and outworked many times. So a little bit surprised that they've started the season this poorly.
Yeah, I'm surprised it started on four. I mean, again, their defense isn't very good. It hurts, right? I mean, you bring in Griba and Reinhardt. I'm not particularly a big fan of Reinhardt's game. It's solid. But, I mean, you know, in the day and age of puck moving, you brought two guys there who are a little bit more your stay-at-home physical guys. Obviously, you gave the big money to Sequeira. And you give long-term deal to Klefbom. So, you know, it's kind of a unit of six there that pretty solidified, it appears, but not that good. I'm surprised that they've started up poorly. I mean, I'm surprised that McDavid hasn't gotten going a little bit more. As he mentions, the Eberle injury, obviously that's a factor. I mean, you don't panic at 0-4, and the truth be told, guys, nobody in this room had him as a playoff team.
Right.
And I don't think the expectation was that they're going to make the playoffs. If they're 2-12, you know, 2-10, and then you got some serious problems. I mean, at some point, you have to start winning hockey games. And you have more talent. As you mentioned, all the additions, Talbot. You have improvements throughout the roster. I mean, you even improved, you know, Letestu's an improvement on the fourth line center. Maybe on the third line, you want a little bit more from them. But Todd McClellan comes in, and from what I could gather from Todd McClellan in San Jose, is he wants to let his players play, put them in position to win. And by that I mean, you know, when San Jose got to the playoffs and was close and, you know, panicked a bit, he kind of always said, you know, it's on the players now to take this to the next step. So that's the kind of coach I think he is. He's not going to alienate people or be a little bit more manipulative, like a Ken Hitchcock, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to let them play. Now, he's just got to get the confidence in the players. I think they have the confidence in him and the freedom that they have. So what I'm saying there is there's an adjustment period as well for the coach. I mean, remember, guys, we talk about the Oilers and how many years they've been terrible. How many coaches have they had? Tom Rennie, Ralph Kruger, the late Pat Quinn, Dallas Aikens, Todd Nelson, Tom McClellan. Think about how many coaches that is. Different styles of coaching, different systems. The preseason, we all agree, is too long. But are they really giving it their all? And then when you get into that first game, you're kind of starting all over again. New goaltender. So, I mean, there is an adjustment period as well. I wouldn't panic. Again, if they get to 2-10, 2-12, something like that, then there might be something more fundamentally wrong. And the bigger problem you have, if you're Edmonton in that case, guys, is you know you're already done. You don't want 4, you still don't think you're done. But if you're 2-10 or something like 2-10, then you know you're done. And it's hard for guys like Taylor Hall and these guys to play seasons where 30 to 40 games into the season, you already know you're out.
What I'm concerned about of the Oilers' start so far is, again, nobody had them in this room to be a playoff team. It doesn't seem like they're doing a good enough job. And I know it's very difficult to do given all the hype and given the first overall pick and the best player since Crosby, et cetera, et cetera. I think they should have done a better job, maybe as the organization, in sort of insulating Connor McDavid. And you know, I know he obviously wants to win and he wants to dominate and he wants to be the player we all think and know that he's going to be. But it seems like they're not doing as much as they could be doing thus far in terms of insulating him from all the pressure and insulating him from a lot of the media scrutiny that comes with being the next one in Edmonton.
I don't know if I agree with that, Drew. I think in this day and age with social media and the fact that we have the 24/7 hockey news cycle, I think there's just way too much overanalysis. I'm not saying that it's not something to bring up, but I mean, this Oilers team isn't very good. And Sidney Crosby came into the league and scored 100 points, and everybody's expecting Connor McDavid to step into the league and score 100 points. And hey, he might turn it up, and he will turn it up. I mean, he averaged 2.5 points a game, pardon me, in the OHL. I mean, Connor McDavid is that good of a talent, Rich.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you got to give him some time here. It's been 4 games. It's only been a week. Like, let's relax.
And you know, his dad even came out with a comment about how much pressure he's facing. And the media, you see the articles on the internet, the Connor watch, Connor McDavid compared to Jack Eichel. The guy's brilliantly talented player.
He'll 18 years old.
He'll be completely fine. Exactly. I like your question, Drew, frankly, better, you know, in terms of the team as a whole, because you lose. How much does it wear on you? But again, it's early for that. It's especially early for an 18-year-old guy who we know is going to be a dominant player.
Like, Drew, Connor McDavid is going to get his goals. He's going to get his assists. He's going to get his points. Whether he gets 50 points or he gets 70 points, I mean, the guy is going to get points. But to say that for some reason, and like Richie's saying, to start comparing McDavid and Eichel, like, should Rich and I start comparing how good our points are for every segment of the radio show?
Look.
Well, I'd be winning, first of all. But, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, how badly do you want to micromanage? Like, do you want to compare how good Connor McDavid is lacing his skates compared to Jack Eichel?
Look, we know that, sure, there's no reason for these articles and these watches to occur. But we know that the media have to fill the airtime. My point is that the Oilers should have done a better job of downplaying expectations for him.
How do they do that, though?
Yeah, I mean, this guy is impossible to do it. For Max Domi, you can do it for, because A, there's nobody covering the team, and B, you know, he's an older guy. He hasn't been written about ad nauseum for 4 years, 5 years. It's like LeBron James. It's the same thing.
I know.
Drew, remember, like, there was no Twitter when LeBron James came into the league, where the coverage was as intense as it possibly could have been. This is the same thing for him.
Asking the Canadian media not to hype up
I'm not asking
Connor McDavid too much is like asking us not to hype up the illegal curve sandwich.
You're
too
not
much.
Hearing me. The Canadian media are going to do what they're going to do. It's on the Oilers organization to.
So how do they affect that?
They pour water. Oh, it's going to be a learning curve for the kids. You can't expect him to come out and be dominant.
You heard that a little bit. You heard Todd McClellan say that quite a bit, Drew. I mean, it's tough, right? Because they don't want to demean him or make him think that he isn't going to play a key role. I mean, look, he's on the second line of the team already.
Well, but I know that. I'm just saying that I know it's very difficult, but I just think there's other things they could have done to prevent people from passing the panel.
It's a fair point.
And if he scores 2 goals this week, everybody's like, Connor McDavid is going to get 80 points.
Probably. But if there's no expectations on those 2 goals, or I mean, the expectations are more reasonable, then it's easier for the.
Well, there's two ways to think about it, Drew. If they continue to play really poorly, then there's less pressure on him because the team stinks and everybody knows they're not going to make the playoffs, and maybe he performs. Conversely, if he performs with a team that is competing and gets less points but experiences a more rigorous schedule because the team is into it more, maybe that's a good thing.
It's been 4 games. If he scores a hat trick tonight against Calgary, we're not having this discussion.
Probably. That's a fair point. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
Watch him. He'll score a hat trick tonight.
Okay.
Just because I said it.
Ezzy the prognosticator. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Lawrence Gilman, the former assistant general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Two hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the program the former assistant general manager of the Vancouver Canucks, also a good Winnipegger, Lawrence Gilman. Lawrence, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Lawrence, we obviously wanted to bring you on to talk about the role of the assistant general manager, your lengthy time with the Vancouver Canucks. You know, we want to start with the salary cap, because we all know that the salary cap, when it was introduced, changed the game of hockey. You know, instead of it just being, you know, going out signing players, you had to work within a budget and work within, you know, everything that the salary cap constraints presented to every team. As someone who has managed the salary cap since its inception, did you prefer working with the salary cap, the first incarnation of the salary cap, or the rewritten cap after the most recent lockout?
The answer to that depends on where you work within the spectrum, whether you work for a big market team or a small market team. I think the best way to illustrate that answer would be by example. And in 2009, when I worked for the Canucks, we were looking to improve our blue line and get a power play defenseman in the summer of 2009. And at the same time, the San Jose Sharks coveted Danny Healy. Danny Healy had a $6 million cap hit, if I'm not mistaken, and San Jose needed to move money in order to make it work so that he could fit into their system. Plus, they also had some contracts that they wanted to rid themselves of. We were able to structure a deal with San Jose whereby we acquired Christian Ehrhoff, who was a very proficient power play defenseman. But in order to do so, we had to take the contract of Brad Lukowich, who was making, I think, about $1.5 million, maybe even $1.75 million. We knew we were taking Brad Lukowich and we were going to send him to the minors because one-way contracts that were sent to the minors did not fall on your salary cap. So we were able to make that deal. We sent Lukowich down, and Christian Ehrhoff was a huge part of our power play and our Stanley Cup run. The new CBA doesn't allow deals like that. If you place a player now, if you have a player on a one-way contract who you send down to the minors, that player's contract counts against your cap with the exception of $950,000. So basically, roughly speaking, if you send a $2 million player down to the minors now, you have a $1 million cap hit. So that's an example where there's been a change in the CBA that leveled the playing field even further with respect to the salary cap. If you're working for a smaller market team, you're happy if with that change, when that change was implemented. If you're working for one of the bigger, probably not so much.
Lawrence, as far as the Vancouver Canucks and yourself were concerned, how difficult was it to adjust to the new CBA? And does the National Hockey League provide guidance to all 30 NHL teams as far as the substantive changes to the most recent CBA? Or were the Vancouver Canucks and all other NHL teams on their own?
Well, the NHL is a very, very well-run league. And when you're talking about any change to the system, the league is very quick and very thorough with respect to the education that it provides to all the 30 teams. In the case of the change from the last cap, the last salary cap system to the current salary cap system, the changes weren't that significant. I mean, first of all, in the lead up to the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement, the league brought in each team on an individual basis to discuss what they liked about the cap, what they didn't like about the cap, and to have a flow of information. We had one of those meetings with the league in New York. We knew what changes were likely going to be implemented. At the same time, I think, and I don't want to put words in the commissioner's mouth, but I read once, or I saw him speak, where he said that he felt that the league got 75% of the cap right when they implemented it originally in 2005. Hmm. So, you know, the changes that were brought in weren't that significant. We knew what was coming, and the league did a very, very good job of supporting us on the front end. And, in fact, they do so every day because the league has a central registry office, which has actually two offices, one in Montreal, one in Toronto, and a hotline where you can contact them almost 24 hours a day. So there's a lot of support provided to each and every team in the league.
Lawrence, can you explain to our listeners how long-term injury reserve works?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated. The long-term injury reserve is in place to allow teams, particularly those at the cap, to have some forgiveness in the event that a player is injured and that injury is substantial. And by substantial and to invoke long-term injury, that means a player has to be gone from your roster for both 10 games and 24 days. And when that occurs, you can exceed the cap by the amount of the player's salary, provided you're at the cap at that time. So again, the best way to answer that is by way of example. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, let's round up the numbers. Cap's at $71 million. And your team is currently sitting at $70 million, $1 million below the cap. And you have a player who's earning $4 million who gets substantially injured, such that you want to place him on LTI. The team would get forgiveness of only $3 million. They could exceed the cap by $3 million. The reason being, they apply the first million, on the $4 million player, they apply the first million to take the team from its $70 million position up to the 71, and then what's left over, the $3 million, can be used for as many players as you want to use until such time as that player is healthy. So the strategy or the capology in that move is, before you invoke the LTI on your $4 million player, you want to try and manipulate your roster to get as close to the $71 million as you possibly can so that you can maximize your efficiency. You might want to maybe recall a player that's making $600,000. So of the $4 million, you might get $3.6 million worth of cap space. So in a perfect world, you're bringing up a guy at $1 million, getting yourself right to the magic number, and then you're as efficient as possible. Now, you got to keep in mind that when that $4 million player is healthy, anybody that you brought up to fill in that gap, they have to be gone. Or, in the alternative, other players have to be gone, or other players have to be on LTI.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is former Vancouver Canucks assistant general manager Lawrence Gilman. Lawrence, you know, we've heard so much talk about advanced stats and new ways of thinking versus old ways of thinking. You were involved in a lot of contract negotiations in your day as the assistant general manager of the Canucks. And now that advanced stats are accessible on NHL.com, you know, everybody's got those numbers at their fingertips. Before those stats were available, how prevalent were those statistics within contract negotiations between teams and players?
They were non-existent in negotiations, and I think the only time statistics really come into play is when you're negotiating a contract for a player where the backdrop is salary arbitration. You're negotiating with an unrestricted free agent. It's an issue of whether the guy wants to stay or whether you're prepared to pay the money that he wants. Mm-hmm. When you're negotiating with a player who has the right to invoke salary arbitration, that's when the statistics come into play. Historically, advanced statistics such as Fenwick, Corsi, PDO, things of that nature have never been introduced into salary arbitration. Therefore, agents and teams, when negotiating deals, never really use them. Interestingly enough, everything evolves, and there is no question in my mind but that the salary arbitration format and system will evolve as advanced stats begin to get introduced. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but when it does, there's going to be an education period that takes place for the arbitrators, because the way the system currently operates, you have a number of arbitrators who have been doing this for years and years and years. They have been rendering opinions and handing down decisions on the basis of traditional hockey stats: goals, assists, points per game, penalty minutes per game, time on ice, the things that people traditionally use. Now, I was involved in a contract negotiation in the past year, which was rather complex, and the agents for the player put forth spent a great deal of time and energy going through the advanced stats with us. And, you know, our position, or my position on behalf of the club, was, you know, all that stuff may be somewhat relevant, but you're going to be handicapped if we ever get to the arbitration setting, because you're going to have to spend a significant amount of the time that you're allotted, because you're only allotted a definitive amount of time. You're going to have to spend a great deal of time educating this arbitrator on what these stats mean. And when you take that time in front of the arbitrator, it's going to eat away from your ability to convince him that your player is actually worth what you say he's worth, or in the alternative, that these stats are actually as relevant as you think they are. And in this instance, we were able to conclude a negotiation, but it's going to be interesting because the arbitrators aren't used to any of the advanced statistics, and it's going to take some time to educate them. And there is going to be some fluctuation in the arbitration market, in my opinion, until they get it straight.
Lawrence, when it comes to projecting the salary cap years down the road, whether it's 1 year down the road or 3 years down the road, do most teams in the NHL have somebody in-house that handles that, or is an outside firm hired? Is it an actuary that crunches the numbers? Who is it that usually handles, you know, calculating the salary cap years down the road?
I can't speak for other organizations, but in the teams that I've worked for, the two teams I've worked for in the salary cap system, we have done it in-house. But at the same time, the National Hockey League does, as I said earlier, does a very, very, very efficient job of informing the teams of the evolution of the game and the business. And the Board of Governors in particular are told by the league typically in their December board meeting where the league thinks projection league revenues will be, which in turn will determine what the salary cap where the salary cap will fall, because the players are guaranteed 50% of league-wide revenues, and they're able to project as the year goes on what those revenues will be, whether it's going to be $3.5 billion, whether it's going to be $3.25 billion, or whether it's going to be who knows, $4 billion. So I don't know that teams necessarily seek outside advice for projection of salary. I can only speak for my experience in Vancouver and in Phoenix.
Lawrence, when the cap came to be, did you know the NHL hadn't been working obviously in a cap system, and teams like Detroit, the Rangers were spending a ton of money. When the cap did come to be, did yourself or other people, you know, contact managers in the NBA or the NFL that have been working in a cap system to kind of learn about the intricacies of it? Granted that the system was going to be a little bit different, but the cap itself would be something that would be similar.
Again, I can't speak for anybody else, but I can speak for myself. And I did contact capologists or people that were responsible for this or had it under their portfolio with both NFL and NBA teams. And their caps are different. One is a hard cap. The NFL is a hard cap, which is similar to the cap we have in hockey, whereas the NBA is a soft cap, which with a number of exceptions that allow you to exceed the cap. There were some rudimentary principles that I sought and got. And one of the biggest questions that I had for these people was, what is the most important thing to keep in mind with respect to operating in your cap system? And, the cap matters more when you're in whatever sport you're in. The cap matters more when you're at the top of it. Mm-hmm. I should say that also matters when you're at the bottom, because there are certain teams, there's some strategy to get to the bottom. You saw this year, for instance, where two players that had significant long-term injuries, Mark Savard and Chris Pronger, were both dealt over the summer to teams that want to use that cap space to manipulate their cap position to get to the floor. So there are things that are inherent in a cap system that both that transcend sports. So I did seek the information from guys in the people in the NBA and the NFL, but again, I can't speak for what other teams did.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Our guest is former Vancouver Canucks assistant general manager Lawrence Gilman. Lawrence, fans know that the salary cap, and they think of the salary cap sort of on a yearly basis, whereas in actuality, it works on a day-by-day basis where you can be, your cap moves based on, the player roster moves you make on a day-by-day basis, as I was saying. If your team is close to exceeding the salary cap on a given day during the NHL season, does the NHL head office advise you of this?
Well, to begin with, you're right. The cap is calculated on a daily basis at an annualized rate. So what happens is when you start, you have to submit an opening day roster. And that opening day roster, the league will look at it on the basis of if this is the roster that the team is putting forth, is it within the confines of the $71.4 million cap? If it is not, the league will not allow you to submit the roster, and you will have to make moves to put yourself in compliance. Now, once the cap begins on day one of the 186-day season, if you are under the cap on day one, that means that in essence, you're banking some cap space. So on day two, you could theoretically be over the cap, provided that that calculation, and it's a minuscule amount on a daily basis. So on day two, you could be over the cap and still be in compliance with what your cap number will be after the 186 days are completed. So what happens over the course of the year is that if you are below the cap, you are accumulating more or less a bank account, which, you know, builds slowly. It's like interest in the bank, which builds slowly over the course of the season. And in there are instances where teams get to the trade deadline and suddenly you could take on a significant amount of money, which takes you well over the cap from about from that point to the balance of the season. So there is the ability to exceed the cap by a significant amount, depending upon where you are at in the year. But the league will not allow you to make a transaction that takes you over the amount on an annualized basis that will whereby your team will spend more than $71.4 million.
Lawrence, we hear a lot about offer sheets in the media, even though they're pretty uncommon. How much attention is the threat of an offer sheet given in your traditional NHL war room?
Well, that depends on where you are with respect to the salary cap. If you're a team that is up at the top of the cap, like, you know, there's speculation that the Boston Bruins were concerned about an offer sheet mm-hmm. and some vulnerability that they had for Doug Hamilton, which is the reason why they traded him to Calgary, or speculated as to the reason they traded him to Calgary. I don't know personally anything about that. But I can tell you that, you know, there's only been one offer sheet in the cap system that wasn't matched. And that was Dustin Penner when the Edmonton Oilers signed him after he'd been playing for the Anaheim Ducks. I have been involved with offer sheets in my experience. We tendered them in Vancouver unsuccessfully. We had a retaliatory offer sheet tendered back to us. I, from my perspective, they get matched. The team's not going to allow a team is not going to allow a good young player to go, no matter how prohibitive the cost is. You can ask the Nashville Predators about that. You know, Philadelphia Flyers tendered a very significant offer sheet to Shea Weber, thinking that Nashville, being a small market team, would never match it. But, you know, there's a credibility issue that organizations have to contend with, and teams don't want to be losing, you know, telling their fans that we couldn't keep this guy just because of money. So from a practical standpoint, they don't really scare me. I guess that's probably the best way for me to answer it to you.
Final question for you, Lawrence. And we had Jay Feaster on last year, and we discussed this with him in regards to the NHL's deal with the CHL and how it relates to the American Hockey League. And it seems like a lot of the players that are playing in junior are kind of ready to play pro, but not old enough to play in the AHL because the rules, as per the NHL and CHL deals, the player has to have played 4 years in the CHL or be 20 years old to be qualified to play in the American Hockey League. Do you ever see the NHL changing its deal or trying to change its deal with the CHL to allow there to be younger players at the pro level if they're ready to play there?
Well, the NHL teams would want that, for sure. But put yourself in the shoes of a CHL team. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at, you know, take a player, you know, the Vancouver Canucks would be a good example. Or I guess you could use the Winnipeg Jets. Josh Morrissey would be a good example. If you're the junior operator, and you're looking, I mean, these players that you're talking about are the top players of the Canadian Hockey League. They're going to be both star players that help their teams win their leagues and potentially win a Memorial Cup. In the alternative, and maybe more significant, they're going to be the ones that help the owners of these junior teams sell tickets. So if you own the Kelowna Rockets or the Vancouver Giants or the Brandon Wheat Kings, you're going to be fighting pretty hard to make sure that these players and this agreement stays in place, because these are marquee players. You know, it's an economy of scale, and these players are marquee players that are going to help you sell your product. I think the junior operators are going to fight tooth and nail to continue to make sure that the agreement as it currently operates stays in place.
Lawrence Gilman is the former assistant general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. He's a proud Winnipegger, of course. Mm-hmm. Lawrence, we really appreciate your time. Your insight into the NHL salary cap and front office machinations have been absolutely outstanding. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on, guys.
Take care, Lawrence. Thanks very much. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We'll recap that interview when we come back. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the Jewish Foundation of Manitoba and their 40th annual luncheon. Philanthropy is a key pillar in a strong community. That's why the Jewish Foundation of Manitoba is proud to support Community Living Manitoba Incorporated and their Strengthening Parent Voices program designed for parents of children and adults with disabilities. For more information about the Jewish Foundation of Manitoba or to purchase tickets to their 40th anniversary luncheon, visit jewishfoundation.org or call 204-477-7520. That interview with Lawrence Gilman, former Canucks assistant general manager, a fantastic interview. And if you missed any of it, we'll have it available on illegalcurve.com and on tsn1290.ca. The thing I didn't know most about that interview, is that if you're below the salary cap, you bank that money that can be used later on in the year. I thought that was one of the more... There were a couple. There were so much interesting things there. That one was interesting to me. And then Lawrence admitting that, you know, advanced statistics previously, until they've become sort of more well-known in the hockey community, were not even a factor, not even a discussion in terms of salary negotiations and salary arbitration negotiations. I thought those were the two interesting takeaways from that interview.
His point was well taken. When you're UFA and a bunch of teams are calling you, you're not going to say, okay, well, your stats, this is going to be how much money can you give me and what's the most appealing part of playing there? Mm-hmm. Again, to get simple. I thought it fascinating when he talks about salary arbitration, and sure, the numbers that you're providing us with may very well have merit, but by the time you've gotten through an explanation to the arbitrator regarding how important these are and what they mean, you've eaten into your time to talk about the true value and the actual figure that you're looking for. So it's an interesting kind of cost benefit in terms of the negotiation and the presenters on each side. I thought he was extremely insightful. I thought that was a really interesting interview.
Yeah, something else to mention too. Lawrence Gilman mentioned this about the offer sheets. Mm-hmm. In Vancouver in 2008, if you remember, those two players that he was referring to, the Vancouver Canucks offer sheeted David Backes. That was matched by the St. Louis Blues. And then the St. Louis Blues came back a week later and offer sheeted Steve Bernier.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was matched. So kind of interesting stuff there. As he mentioned, Dustin Penner was the last offer sheet that was actually accepted.
Yeah. Just fantastic interview. I mean, just the insight he provided into the machinations of a front office and everything else along those lines. I thought that was just a tremendous interview. In case you missed any of it, it'll be available on tsn1290.ca. It'll be available on illegalcurve.com. And while you're at it, just subscribe to the show via iTunes. You get it sent to you each and every week.
Can you subscribe to the sandwich?
No, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Let's go to break. When we come back, Brendan Savage of MLive.com will join us to talk about the Detroit Red Wings and their hot start to the season. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Eleven 30 in the morning. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment of the show brought to you by Royal Sports. Since 1974, Royal Sports has been Winnipeg's number one hockey shop, plus so much more, like soccer to shoes to snowboards. For locations, hours, and more, check them out online at royalsports.me.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He covers the Detroit Red Wings for MLive.com, Brendan Savage. Brendan, good morning and welcome to the program.
It's afternoon here, but thank you.
Yes, Eastern Time Zone versus Central Time Zone. You are correct. It is afternoon there in Michigan. Brendan,
yes.
Always appreciate you.
Snowing, too.
Yes, exactly. Always appreciate you joining us here on the program. Wanted to bring you on, talk about the Red Wings, 3-1 to start the year. And, you know, they have one of the hottest lines going to start. You know, Justin Abdelkader, Henrik Zetterberg, and Dylan Larkin. Want to start with Larkin. First round pick last year, 15th overall. You know, it's rare. You know, the Red Wings are known for being a team that really takes their time in developing their prospects. You know, is Larkin that special of a player that he was able to sort of skip the Red Wings' way of going about being a prospect and getting into the lineup this early in his career?
Well, it's still early, so, you know, I wouldn't get too excited about him. But from everything he's shown, he is a special player. And, you know, they gave him a pretty good audition in the preseason. They played him five games, and he played against some prospects, but he also played against some team veteran players. He played in Pittsburgh, he played in Chicago, he played in Boston, and they dressed some of their top players that night, and he played well. So I think they gave him every chance to make the team, but I think they also gave him every chance to show that he maybe wasn't ready and needed a little bit more seasoning, and he didn't do that. And Jeff Blashill's a big fan, so I think maybe you're seeing a little changing of the ways in Detroit with Mike Babcock gone to Toronto. Babcock liked his veterans, and Blashill saw Larkin last year in the playoffs, liked him, and you see what he's doing here so far. I think he's part of the reason you've seen Henrik Zetterberg re-energized a little bit.
Brendan, the two big acquisitions for the Detroit Red Wings in the offseason were obviously Mike Green and Brad Richards. How have those two fit in early on in the season? Are they still trying to find their legs here, or have they fit in nicely in the roles that were expected of them?
I think they're fitting in. You know, I think it's going to take a little bit of time. It's only four games, but I thought Richard played pretty well last night in a game where not many of the Red Wings did play very well. Larkin also, I thought, played okay. I think Green is going to be helped by Danny DeKeyser returning. He's going to play tonight. And DeKeyser is one of their better, if not their best, defensive defensemen. Babcock loved him back there. And I think they're going to pair him with Green. That's the plan. And maybe with him back there, that'll give Green a little bit more freedom to express himself offensively and maybe not expose him as much if he does.
Brendan, Johan Franzen, you know, was feeling better coming into the preseason, started off, playing among the top 12. And I think maybe the Wings were hoping that they could have a full, healthy season from the Mule. Now he's got this return of concussion symptoms. What's going on there?
Well, he didn't talk yesterday, so we're not really sure how he's feeling, but I know Blashill's very concerned, so he feels bad for him, and it doesn't sound good to me. I mean, the guy hadn't played since January 6th. He was finally cleared. I'm not sure if it was the start of camp or midway through camp. And even when he started skating, it kind of struck me as funny that he kept saying, well, when I exert myself too much, I'm not feeling real great. So, this does not sound good to me, to be honest.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Brendan Savage. Brendan covers the Detroit Red Wings for MLive.com. Brendan, you look at the Red Wings goaltending, and, you know, Jimmy Howard seems like he's been there forever and ever at this point in time, or at least in the Red Wings organization. Mm-hmm. Peter Mrazek there as the backup. You know, is it going to be a timeshare situation for the two of them throughout the course of the year, or do you expect that at some point in time Jeff Blashill is going to lean more on one of the goaltenders as opposed to the other?
You know, Blashill's a former goalie, and he knows how that whole thing works with the psyche of the goalie. So you would think at some point he would go with one guy as the clear-cut number one, but right now he says he's going to alternate them, especially because they've got back-to-backs four times this month. Tonight's the second one, and then they've got the next 2 weeks they play back-to-back. So, you know, I think he thinks that'll keep them fresh, and I think it's a good thing because it'll also have them push each other. Howard really hasn't had anybody push him since he's been the number one goalie. You know, Ty Conklin didn't do it. Joey McDonald didn't do it. Jonas Gustafsson was hurt all the time. He didn't do it. Peter Mrazek's going to do it. I thought a couple years ago Mrazek would be the number one goalie of the future. I just didn't think it would happen as quickly as it did last year. So I think you're going to see them push each other, and eventually I think he will name a number one. But, you know, who knows? He could platoon them the whole season.
By the way, Brendan, thanks for bringing up Ty Conklin. It's been a long time since we've had a nice Ty Conklin reference on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Wanted to ask you about Teemu Pulkkinen. Dylan Larkin's obviously getting a lot of the headlines. He was a 15th overall pick, but Pulkkinen's a guy that absolutely tore up the AHL last year with Grand Rapids. What's impressed you the most about Pulkkinen so far playing on that third line?
Oh, he's just got a cannon for a shot. It's unbelievable how big his shot is for such a little guy, but I was saying the other night to somebody that, you know, I guess it's all about rhythm and timing and all that good stuff, because you see golfers who are 5'8", 140 pounds, hitting the ball, you know, 290, 300 yards. So his shot is just big. I think he's still kind of trying to find his way in the NHL. You know, he's got to find places to get open. but he does have three goals in four games. Now, that said, last night it was kind of a fluky tip in front, but he's got three against Carolina. So he's another guy who's a bright prospect. I thought that was kind of funny. One of the things Babcock said last year was he didn't see a lot of talent in the organization, and I think they've got a ton of talent down in the minors, guys like Alexei Marchenko, who they just sent down, Xavier Ouellette, Anthony Manthei. I still wouldn't write him off. Andreas Athanasio, I think he's going to be a special player. And then you've got Larkin and some of the guys that are up right now, like Polkanen. I think there's a lot of talent there.
You mentioned Babcock, so you took the words out of my mouth. What was the reaction in Detroit, Brendan, of his return this past week with the Maple Leafs? And was there any talk around the Red Wings organization about Mike Commodore's tweets?
No, nobody's really talked about that. We've talked about it a lot. We thought it was kind of funny. Somebody on our live blog that night asked us what was being said, and we said, you're going to have to look yourself. We can't publish this stuff. This is not for a family newspaper or website. But, they did a nice little tribute to him halfway through the first period to Babcock. They showed him holding up the cup in 08 on the screen, and they thanked him for 10 seasons of service. And the fans gave him a standing ovation, and he gave him a little wave. But by the end of the game, they were yelling, Babcock, go home, and things like that. So, I'm not sure there were some fans that were upset, but I'm not sure it was a terrible disappointment to everybody, because I think people knew it was time for him to move on, and a lot of the players were ready for him to move on, despite what they've said publicly.
Brendan Savage is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Brendan covers the Detroit Red Wings for MLive.com. Brendan, we mentioned, Babcock, and obviously, 10 years is a long time to be a head coach in one place. Do you get the feeling that there's sort of a rejuvenation to the organization with Blashill coming in, with Babcock, heading out to Toronto, and, all these young players being infused around the veterans of Zetterberg and Datsyuk when he gets into the lineup, and Brad Richards coming over from Chicago? Do you get sort of the sense that there's a rejuvenation to the organization?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think you can see it in Zetterberg, for starters. He's had a lot of weight lifted off his shoulders without Babcock there anymore. I don't think they had the greatest relationship in the world. I don't think they hated each other, but, I think maybe he just got tired of Babcock's kind of heavy-handed ways, and I think some of the other guys are the same way. I asked Zetterberg the other night what the difference was early in the season, because he just seems like he's got more jump, more energy, he's having fun. And he kind of downplayed it, but Justin Abdelkader had an interesting comment where he said, well, he's healthy and he's feeling good, and I think maybe the new coaching change might have made a difference. So, I think that's a big thing for a lot of those guys. Now, how long it lasts, we don't know. But a lot of these younger guys, too, are kind of coming in and kind of infusing some young talent. And a lot of them really, really like Blashill from their days in Grand Rapids. And you would expect them to say that when you ask them, but I get the feeling that they're being very sincere, because Blashill's a very likable guy. He's in like Babcock in some ways, but in a lot of ways he's not. He's more laid back. He's not soft, but he's more laid back, and I think he just relates to the players a little bit better than Babcock did. He wasn't a player's coach, but again, I don't think that's necessarily bad either.
Yeah, you mentioned Justin Abdelkader, Brendan. He's really really becoming more, people are becoming more aware of him and his talents. Is he a nice mix in terms of this group? You have a lot of skill, some east-west. His ability to play kind of north-south and play with skilled players, is that a great complement to the players he's playing with now, whether it be Larkin and Zetterberg now, but maybe Datsyuk when he comes back?
I think so. He's not a heavyweight by any stretch, and he's not a huge tough guy, but he's not afraid to get his nose dirty, and I think that's good to have him out there with Zetterberg and Larkin to kind of watch their backs a little bit. He'll throw his body around. He'll go in the corners. A lot of Red Wings fans a couple of years ago weren't real thrilled with him because he wasn't scoring a lot of goals. But I've always liked Abdelkader because he does all the little things that you need guys to do if you want to have a successful team.
Brendan, Landon Ferraro is a guy that's gone into the lineup a little bit here due to injury. What has his play been like so far?
He's been pretty solid. He's been throwing his body around a lot. I did a story the other day about how much the Red Wings are hitting this year. They've out-hit, I think, every team so far. And behind Abdelkader, he's he's the one throwing his body around a lot, and he's good on the penalty kill. You know, he's a defensive specialist now, even though I think he had 27 goals last year in Grand Rapids, and then he played well in the playoffs. So he knows his role, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens once everybody starts getting healthy, because they're going to have some decisions to make. You know, Darren Helms coming back tonight from a concussion. Joachim Andersen, who's been a healthy scratch the first four games, he's going to play tonight. DeKaiser's coming back tonight. So, I think Andersen could be your odd man out once they have to make a move when Datsyuk comes back. But who knows if Ferraro could be the guy, too. I like Ferraro. He's the type of guy, like I said, like Abdelkader, who you need those types of guys to do the little things that aren't necessarily glamorous or fun to do, but you need them if you want to have a good team.
Brendan Savage covers the Detroit Red Wings for MLive.com in Michigan. Brendan, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime, guys. Thank you.
Take care, Brendan. Let's head to break. Yeah. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. One final segment on the other side.
Well, obviously the biggest, I mean, there's no better place than the Stanley Cup in Montreal, and I've been here my whole career, and having that chance to win it here, the team we have, there's a big chance that we can really do some damage in the next couple of years, so I'm really happy about it and hoping that we'll do that.
That's Montreal Canadiens center Thomas Plekanec signing a two-year, $12 million contract extension yesterday, an average annual value, a salary cap hit of $6 million per season for the next 2 years. One final segment, news and notes for this Saturday morning here on TSN 1290.
NHL news and notes.
Your thoughts on this contract signing. $6 million is the same average annual value he's currently making at the end of a five-year, $30 million deal. Is this just a logical contract? You know, what were your thoughts when you heard about this one yesterday?
I mean, we've said there's really no such thing as a bad one-year contract. I think when you're dealing with a guy like Thomas Plekanec, when you really know what you're getting, there's certainly not anything wrong with a two-year contract. I mean, he's a guy who can play both ways. He's a two-way center. He's responsible.
He's a very good two-way center.
They know exactly what they're getting. He can score a bit. He can pass the puck. You can play him in all situations. I mean, and Plekanec wanted to be there. Remember, before the season, he had mentioned to the media that really he wasn't approached and negotiations weren't going anywhere. This is a guy who wanted to be there because he likely could have got more money in term elsewhere. Certainly more term elsewhere. If you're the Habs, I mean, of course, the guy's, you know, early 30s here. You can get him on a couple-year deal, no long-term commitment into his late 30s, and you know what you're getting, and you know he's been a loyal soldier. So it works for both squads. I give credit to Plekanec. He's taking less money here to stay with the team he wants to win with. And I bet you he could have got a four-year deal or less annual value, but certainly more term. And I think it makes sense.
Yeah, Rich, I don't think any of us thought that Plekanec was going to get a 5 or 6 year deal with the Montreal Canadiens. So the two-year deal makes sense for them. And as you mentioned, he probably gets more money and more term on the free agent market. But
I think he left 3 years, 15 out somewhere on there for sure.
Yeah, I think that's right, Rich. And with Plekanec, I think that he's almost underrated for how good of a player he is. I think Plekanec takes a little bit of criticism because of how the team does in the playoffs, and especially last year. I think he only had two or three points in the playoffs last year. And, you know, but he was really good for them a couple of years back.
Yeah, 4 points in 12 games.
Yeah, sorry.
In the
playoffs, so he had 4 points.
But he had 60 points in 82 regular season games.
He's a consistent 55 or 60 point guy, but this guy is an excellent two way player. I would say he's probably top 10 in the league as far as two way centers go. But, you know, he's been good for them in the playoffs. As Rich mentioned, he's been a loyal foot soldier. But Alex Galchenyuk right now is their second-line center. He's not quite ready to take over, and they need him. And he's been really good there with Pacioretty over the years, and Brendan Gallagher's also on the right side of that top line. So it's a good signing. And like I said, they need him. You know, again, are they a little bit too small up the middle? Probably Desharnais has moved down to the third-line center.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this team still is going to rely on goaltending and defense a lot of the time to win games.
And one thing you want is at the end of this 2 years, if earlier than that, probably you hope Galchenyuk's passed him for number one center. Mm-hmm. And then when you have to sign Galchenyuk to his deal after his two-year bridge deal is up. You only have 1 year of Plekanec left, so you want to have a huge commitment at the middle.
Should make note, there's absolutely no trade clause or no movement clause involved in that deal.
He probably had to give that up because he signed for less years, right?
You think he'd get it?
You think he would get it if he only
said... I don't think they're moving unless they tank.
It would be unusual. Yeah. But
I think from the team's perspective, that's why he didn't get it. Right? Because he signs for 2 years. If he has the ability to get moved, then they're really kind of, I don't know. I can see why the team pushed for that, but...
On injury news, Logan Couture, the San Jose Sharks, he fractures his fibula at the ankle. He's going to be out 4 to 6 weeks.
That's really unfortunate, Drew.
Yeah, it happens in practice. It's just a sort of a freak injury that happens in the Sharks' practice a couple days ago. Obviously a significant impact to the Sharks, especially given how well they've been going at the start of the season. I know they say 4 to 6 weeks. 4 weeks seems awfully short to come back from that. And when you're dealing with something like a broken ankle, it's hard to believe you're ever back at full strength in the course of the entire season.
Yeah, Couture is one of their best players, but they'll be fine without Logan Couture. I mean, but you're talking about a perennial kind of 25-30 goal guy, right? So it's unfortunate, like you mentioned. The Sharks have been probably the biggest surprise to start the season, at least when you consider how bad they were last year and missing the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you hope that, you know, he's back in 4 or 5 weeks. You hope that it isn't something that keeps him out of the lineup for, you know, 7, 8 weeks. But, you know, you have guys that can pick up the slack, whether it's Thornton or Marlowe or Pavelski. And, you've got a lot of young players on the team that can pick up that slack, Hurdle, Wingles.
But Hurdle's picking up the slack as of last night, playing with Marlowe and Ward. And that was the second line, Marlowe, Couture, and Ward. And if you can throw that out with Thornton and Pavelski anchoring the first line, you really have nice depth, and you put Hurdle on the third line. Hurts your depth. I mean, that's an injury that really, really hurts you in terms of how it happens. Practice. I mean, Couture's arguably your second, third best offensive player, good skater, really good shot, can really do it all. I mean, he can play wing, and obviously he's playing center this season. So that's a huge injury, Drew, for a team that really got off on a good note. Hurdle is able to elevate. Certainly they don't need him to play better than he did last season, and I think he got a point last night in their shootout game against Jersey. But that's a tough one, and you wonder if you're San Jose that's going to hurt your momentum at the top of the season here. Granted, it may make you buy in more defensively, and certainly with Martin Jones playing and Paul Martin solidifying your top four there, that might not be, you know, might be something that ends up helping you out later on in the year, that you buy in earlier to defense, and then it helps you when you get the offensive player back.
Yeah, well, apparently the Sharks are only going to need to score one goal a game to win.
Well, yeah.
Martin Jones, a .982 save percentage through his first four starts, and a .49
goals. That's not going to be sustainable.
You think?
He's a good goalie, though.
Is that a bold prediction on your part there?
Big prediction there,
I mean, when Jones came into the league, though, with L.A., I mean, he tore it up, too. He was getting shutouts. So, I mean, back to Richie's point, and I know Drew's going to look like a genius for picking the Sharks to make the playoffs because nobody else did. But, I mean, this guy's a good goalie, right? So
odds are pretty good between now and the end of the season. I'll say something pretty stupid that'll make people not think I'm a genius.
Just don't pick the Royals to win the series.
Well, that's Hustler's bag. I'm not going to touch that one. In Tampa Bay, Nikita Nesterov suspended for 2 games for his hit from behind on Curtis McKenzie of the Dallas Stars. McKenzie was hospitalized as a result of the hit. 2 games enough for this hit? It was pretty blatant and pretty bad.
Yeah, you probably could have given him... a few more games, guys, but as we know, whenever you think the NHL should be giving out 3, 4, 5 games, usually they're a little bit lenient. I actually like Nesterov. If you remember in the playoffs last year, Nesterov came in for the Lightning in the playoffs, and he was pretty solid, but it was a dirty hit, and you'd never want to see a guy get injured. So should he have gotten more games, Drew? Probably. Sets a better example, right? Mm-hmm. But as we know, the NHL usually calls these by the book.
I'm going to take a little bit of a different stance on this one.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the NHL is, you're going to get your pass out of your own zone. You're going to make the pass, you know, you're going to make your D-to-D pass in right around your own zone and make a pass up the boards to the weak side. And defensemen are taught and need to be able to rotate to that side and seal the boards and take away any time and space from the winger. So when I watch that play, I don't see Nesterov with malicious intent to hurt McKenzie. I see him as trying to seal the takeaway space and take away and do his job, and McKenzie's caught in an awkward position, and Nesterov is following through on it. I thought 1 game was sufficient. He gets 2. I don't mind if the NHL errs on the side of safety, so I don't have an issue with it. I don't think this was as bad as maybe some others do.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stink like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Ezra Ginsberg.
Cheering the Arizona Coyotes. This team had no expectations heading into the year. Everybody picked them to miss the playoffs, including the three of us. Mm-hmm. They've won three of their first four games, including the Kings, the Penguins, and the Ducks. So good for them. Three of their first four games are wins. It's nice to see.
Richard Pollock.
This week, I get to vote on one of the voters on the new nickname for the University of North Dakota hockey team.
You get to vote as an alum?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's five options.
Yes.
Fighting Hawks.
Okay.
Nodaks. North Stars, which I kind of like. Rough Riders. And Sun Dogs, which I don't like. And my decision is between the Nodaks and the North Stars. I think I'm going to vote for the Nodaks. I like that one. But that's nice that they're going to have a new name, and I'll cheer that.
I'm going to the game tonight.
Yeah.
There you go. And I'll wrap up cheers and jeers by just cheering, going out to vote in general. Richie's going to vote.
Democracy.
Democracy. I'll cheer for democracy. Go out and vote whoever you want to vote for. Go out and vote on Monday.
Can we vote you off the island?
You can vote me off the island. You can vote me off the show. But go out and vote on Monday.
Trump 2016.
Yeah. I don't know if you can vote for Donald Trump. But anyways, go out and vote on Monday. That's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guest, Brendan Savage of MLive.com. He covers the Red Wings. Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch to talk about the Blues, and Lawrence Gilman, the former assistant general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. In case you missed any of the interviews, in case you missed any of the shows, they'll be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, Jewish Foundation of Manitoba, Keener Jerseys, and Royal Sports. For producer Rory and producer Chris, for Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for Blue Jays and Royals later on this afternoon here on TSN 1290.